You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're listening for the first time, this is a sample episode as part of the Kick-Ass Politics preview station. If you like what you hear, there are many more episodes to enjoy on our main podcast page at Kick-Ass Politics with Ben Mathis. You can subscribe for free by going to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes or go to the link in the information page for this episode. Also, feel free to check out our website for show notes, book recommendations, and more at kickasspolitics.com. And now I hope you enjoy this preview episode of Kick-Ass Politics. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Audible has over 180,000 audiobooks available to download for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And right now, Kick-Ass Politics listeners can get a free audiobook as part of Audible's free 30-day trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com and go get your free audiobook. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. Well, this week, President Obama finally got his nuclear deal with Iran, the one he's been so desperate to hang in his presidential library as the crowning achievement of his foreign policy. Iran's happy. Heck, they're celebrating in the streets. Of course, they're also chanting death to America at the same time. Kind of seems ungrateful. The president is happy, or at least that's how he's spinning it. But that's about it. Republicans in Congress are livid over this agreement, and it appears that a good number of Democrats are joining them in denouncing the deal with Iran. Among the P5 plus one, those are the nations that negotiated for this deal alongside the U.S., that's Britain, Germany, France, China, and Russia, I haven't heard of one of them hailing this deal as some kind of great victory or throwing around the words Nobel Prize. Well, maybe Russia's a little bit happy. After all, Vladimir Putin likes to have friends in low places, and rogue nations don't balk when you invade your neighbor. But Israel isn't cheering, and for once, the neighboring Arab states agree with them. Not only is the prospect of a nuclear Iran a destabilizing factor in the region, but many fear that this deal may be taken as a green light for other Middle East nations, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia, to pursue their own nuclear weapons programs in a deadly game of keeping up with the Joneses. Well, today we're going to find out just what's in this deal and what this means for the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East in general with my guest, Michael Rubin. He's a scholar with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, specializing in the Middle East and Iran in particular. He served as an advisor to the Secretary of Defense on matters relating to Iran, and he even lived in post-revolutionary Iran for a while. He's written extensively on the subject of a nuclear Iran, including his most recent book, Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes. In just a moment, he's going to tell me whether the nuclear deal with Iran is a coup for the U.S. and our allies, or a complete disaster. You can probably guess which side he falls on. So stay tuned for that in just a moment.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm joined by Michael Rubin. He's a scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ben.
You've been following this entire process with Iran very closely. First, just walk us through this. What's in this deal? What does Iran get from it, and what do we get out of this?
Well, ultimately, what Iran gets is to normalize and legalize its once illicit nuclear program. Back in 2005, the International Atomic Energy Agency had found Iran in noncompliance with its Nuclear Nonproliferation Safeguards Agreement. In effect, they found that Iran was cheating and that they were doing covert work they weren't declaring. Of course, over subsequent years, Iran, it was discovered, had covert enrichment facilities and so forth, and there was a whole series of UN sanctions on Iran. All the while, Iran said, look, there's nothing to see here. The sanctions should be lifted, and our nuclear program is absolutely peaceful. What this deal has done is basically buy into Iran's line. There's going to be some constraints for the next 10 years or so, but after that, Iran is home free. What does the United States get? President Obama will say that the United States has put off by a decade any possibility that Iran can break out and develop a nuclear weapon. However, many of President Obama's critics, myself included, look at the deal and question the basis for that claim.
Right after the deal was announced, Hassan Rouhani, the president of Iran, took to Twitter. And here's what he said. He said, to our neighbors, do not be deceived by the propaganda of the warmongering Zionist regime. Iran and its power will translate into your power. That's the guy we just struck a deal with. Pretty ominous. What does he even mean by that when he says Iran's power will translate into your power?
Well, ultimately, what Iran is saying is we are now the hegemon. If you side with us, we are the umbrella under which you need to sit. But it's important. I mean, one of the main things that President Obama has never really understood, nor John Kerry, the Secretary of State for that matter, is that Iran isn't a status quo power. At its heart, it's an ideological power. And when they look at Hassan Rouhani, the current president, and they want to see a moderate, that's what they see. But they forget that between 1988 and 2005, he was the director of Iran's National Security Council. During that time, he was responsible for the buildup of Iran's covert nuclear and nuclear weapons program. As he was about to step down in 2005, he gave a speech at Ferdowsi University in Mashhad, which is Iran's second largest city, in which he basically said, in detailing the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, that every point in time, Iran has triumphed over the United States because we have a doctrine of surprise. We lull them into complacency, and then we deliver a knockout blow. I'm worried that he's following that path to a T.
Well, you're right that, when Hassan Rouhani was elected, everyone was so quick to try and hail him as a supposed moderate. As Margaret Thatcher said of Mikhail Gorbachev, this was supposedly a guy that we could do business with. And from everything that I've seen with him attending rallies where they're shouting death to America, death to Israel, just 4 days before this announcement of this deal, and the things that he's saying on Twitter and so forth, it doesn't really seem like he is the moderate that we thought
he would be.
But then again, does Rouhani even really matter in this equation?
Well, I mean, Ben, first of all, he's not the moderate. You're absolutely right with that. He's just very much more careful about his public relations and public face. He's willing to pull the wool off people's eyes if he can find enough useful idiots that he can blind. And he's done that very successfully when it comes to Secretary of State John Kerry. But let's say, for the sake of argument, like you suggest, that Rouhani is sincere and that Mohammad Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, is sincere. Even if they are as sincere as can be, they have no power to implement this deal. Let's put aside the supreme leader of Iran who calls the shots. And he hasn't committed to this deal by any means. All he's said is that we need to study it with a fine-tooth comb. But it's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps which control the areas of the nuclear program that are most concerned to us. For example, the possible military dimensions, the Parchin military base where Iran in the past worked with nuclear weapons triggers, for example. Well, in a situation like that, the IRGC has said they are not going to abide by this deal. And therefore, I mean, even after the deal was signed, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said under no circumstances would any inspectors be allowed on military facilities. Basically, this is a deal that John Kerry wanted because he wanted in his hand a piece of paper that said he had a deal, but will achieve what he says? Absolutely not. The Iranians played him for a fool. And just one final aspect to illustrate the extent of this, we're giving Iran about $100 billion in a signing bonus. A lot of that, admittedly, is their own money and frozen assets and so forth. But that's equivalent to retroactively funding over 20 years of Iran's illicit, covert nuclear and ballistic missile programs. And that's before they even really have to do anything at all.
I'm wondering why our approach in these negotiations was so weak to begin with. You know, when I heard stories being leaked out from the negotiations that the Iranian negotiator was screaming and yelling at John Kerry, to the point even that at one point, supposedly, they say Secret Service had to rush into the room because they thought that the Secretary of State of the United States was being assaulted. I mean, and I hear how the diplomats were essentially bullying and disrespecting the U.S. negotiators. I mean, the U.S., the most powerful country in the world, went into this from day one, pardon the expression, essentially acting as if we're Iran's bitch. I mean, do you have any insight into why we chose this weak approach?
The way I look at it is it's almost as if we're playing poker, and we were dealt a royal flush. The Iranians were dealt a pair of twos, but for some reason, John Kerry turned in four cards and ended up with nothing while the Iranians got a full house in the end. It's an absolute case study in how not to negotiate. And you're absolutely right. The Iranian government, that is trying to humiliate the United States. We see this in Rouhani's statements. We see this in Khamenei's statements. You know, when you look at what he says in Persian, for example, on the 30th anniversary of the seizure of the American embassy, he gave a speech in which he was mocking President Obama for constantly writing him letters begging him for things, and yet President Obama is just oblivious, putting away on the golf course.
Yeah, and it's funny because now everyone is, there are so many comparisons between Obama and Neville Chamberlain. And when I look back, Neville Chamberlain was an idiot and he was gullible, but I feel that he at least was acting in good conscience for what he believed in his own mind was in the best interest of Great Britain. He was trying to prevent the same bloodshed they had had in World War I. I don't see that when I look at this negotiation. It seems to have been done purely for vanity's sake.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Look, the biggest difference between Obama and Kerry on one hand and Neville Chamberlain on the other was Neville Chamberlain was appeasing Hitler, and that was wrong, but he was doing it to give Great Britain more time to build up its military, to build up its leverage. I mean, what President Obama has done is essentially eviscerate the U.S. military at the same time this is going on to pre-World War II levels. And make no mistake, a good portion of this $100 billion that Iran is going to get is going to go into missiles that can attack the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf, because don't forget, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has said the U.S. Navy has no business being in the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has announced they're working in underwater sabotage. I think a much better analogy to what John Kerry has done is predates Neville Chamberlain and goes to Frank Kellogg, the former U.S. Secretary of State in 1928, who came up with this fantastic treaty to forever prevent war, the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And for that, he won a Nobel Prize, but it paved the way for a devastating world war. I think John Kerry may get his Nobel Prize, and he's going to pave the way for a far greater conflict.
Yeah, I think you very well may be right. And the other thing that confuses me about this, I get why Obama was desperate for a foreign policy legacy and why he made this deal. I even get why Russia and China, who have their own interests in seeking the lifting of sanctions on Iran, went for this. But why did the other nations in the P5 plus one, the Europeans, France, Germany, and the UK, get on board with this deal? What did they have to gain in this?
Well, I think when it comes to the Europeans, it's all mercantile interests, and it always has been. The European Union, of course, also wanted a deal because the Iran portfolio is the first foreign policy challenge which the Europeans took on outside the confines of the European Union itself, and they wanted to show that multilateralism works, that they could save the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But behind the scenes, and this goes back, for example, to 1992, 1993, when Germany launched this critical engagement where they would tie trade with Iran addressing human rights, it quickly became apparent as trade tripled that human rights fell by the wayside. And according to the UN special rapporteur at the point, the death penalty had doubled in Iran alongside German trade, so much for the critical aspect of critical engagement.
Well, yeah, it's strange to me, too, that Iran is already getting to enrich uranium and to pursue a nuclear program, supposedly for peaceful means. So why did we throw in all of these extra goodies, lifting sanctions on terrorists, basically, like Qassem Soleimani, the head of the Quds forces, and Ahmad Vahidi? That wasn't necessary. If this was about Iran's nuclear program, then why did we cave on all of these other points?
Well, I think it's a testament to the lack of skill of American negotiators, number one. They got played, and what John Kerry never understood is the more you show desperation, the more the Iranians are going to take advantage of you. And ultimately, they concluded that Kerry and Obama wanted the deal much more than the Iranians wanted the deal, so they kept throwing on demands and getting them accepted until, frankly, they ran out of demands. I mean, think about it this way. Iran is holding four U.S. hostages, some of whom have been held for more than 7 years. And yet Iran's getting a $100 billion windfall, and we can't get our four Americans home. I mean, maybe if they had betrayed their country, then Obama would have released people from Guantanamo Bay on their behalf. But in this case, Saeed Abedini is in prison because he's a Christian. And Amir Hekmati is a former U.S. Marine and Iranian-American who got Iran's permission before going and then ended up getting arrested anyway. I mean, ultimately, this is absolutely astounding. And no wonder President Obama at his press conference was so touchy on the subject, because he really has no defense.
It's hard for me to understand our thinking in this process, because we not only caved on our big asks, but we even caved on our small asks.
When it comes time for the Senate to look this over, and the metric which they should use is simply comparing what President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and Wendy Sherman said a year or two ago versus what the state of the final deal is. For example, and President Obama, when he was speaking at Brookings, I think, in December 2013, with relation to Fordo, this under-the-mountain nuclear facility, once covert, built near Qom, what President Obama said is he sees no reason why any peaceful nuclear program should need a facility like that, and that it wouldn't be in the final deal, and yet Iran gets to keep it in the final deal. And we have this time and time again. We're allowing Iran 5,000 to 6,000 centrifuges. What President Obama doesn't acknowledge is that Pakistan built not a nuclear bomb, but an arsenal of nuclear bombs with 3,000 of the same centrifuges. And this idea of anytime, anywhere inspections, it's actually going to take more than 24 days. That's like making the police get the suspect's signature on a search warrant, and then they get to have to wait 24 days before they can serve it. It's absolutely inane.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. Any time in the past when we've gone into similar negotiations like this, say, you know, with Gaddafi a few years back under George Bush, we've always asked that they come clean about what they've been doing up to this point. If we don't even require Iran to come clean about its nuclear ambitions up to this point, and they've had an underground enrichment facility, which, I mean, let's be frank, why else would someone have a heavily defended facility under a mountain if they're not trying to enrich uranium for military purposes? And the leadership seems to continually talk out of the side of their mouth throughout this whole negotiation problem. In what way do we feel that we're negotiating with an honest broker here, or even a rational partner, when you look at some of the things they've said?
Well, I don't understand how this administration thinks that it's being clever. ultimately, Iran's actions talk more than its words regardless. And over the last few years, Iran has been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Americans. They've killed hundreds of thousands of Syrians inside Syria. They're in Yemen and so forth. They're trying to destabilize Bahrain. They've been trying to destabilize Azerbaijan. They are an aggressive power. They do it not through direct invasion, but they do it through asymmetric warfare, and they speak openly about it. They used to have a line item in their budget for resistance, and they only took that out after it was used in a various U.S. court cases to assign damages to the victims of Iranian-supported terrorism. But you brought up a great point, Ben, about verification and past countries coming clean. In 1991, South Africa decided to give up its military nuclear program. And in order for the International Atomic Energy Agency to certify that South Africa had come in from the cold, they required that South Africa come clean on the past 20 years of its activities so that the IAEA could certify that all materials were present and accounted for. That was the baseline. South Africa had a much simpler program, and they were cooperating. That's what the IAEA has said it needs for Iran. But in order to get the deal, John Kerry said, let's just trust Iran.
I'll just ask you point blank, considering all of that, is this deal even worth the paper it's printed on?
No, it's not worth the paper it's printed on, not at all. Although, the paper it's printed on is worth more than $100 billion for the Islamic Republic of Iran. But what we're doing is unleashing a cascade of proliferation in the world's most insecure region, on top of which we're releasing tens of billions, more than $100 billion that Iran can use to flood this area with weaponry as well. I don't know how anyone thinks that any good can come of that.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point, too. In this deal, they lift supposedly $100 billion to potentially $150 billion in sanctions, and we didn't put anything in place as far as assurances that those funds won't go to terrorist organizations like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Assad regime, who's largely been funded by Iran. Are we basically now endorsing and funding terrorism?
Put it this way. I don't think we're endorsing it. I don't think President Obama would go that far. But we are, at the very least, enabling it, and enabling it in a way which shows severe policy incompetence, malpractice, if you will. And President Obama may think that he is going down as a man of peace. They're not going to name public buildings after him in the Middle East. They're going to be naming graveyards after him.
I fear that you're right. And when I say endorsing terrorism, it's bizarre to me that we lifted sanctions on people like Qassem Soleimani and Ahmed Vahidi, who are essentially terrorists. If we haven't endorsed these terrorists, then at the very least, we've essentially given them complete forgiveness from the U.S.
Well, you're absolutely right there. Of course, Ahmed Vahidi is the former defense minister of Iran under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the first world's defense minister to have an Interpol red notice on him because he was the mastermind of the 1994 Buenos Aires bombing against not the Israeli embassy, but against the Jewish Cultural Center. And Qassem Soleimani is the man responsible for smuggling in all those explosively formed projectiles, which killed and maimed American forces in Iraq. And by the way, this is after Mohammad Javad Zarif had promised complete non-interference in Iraq, which shows that the Iranian foreign minister with whom we're striking a bargain is either a liar or is insincere or he can't enforce his own agreements. Regardless, what really shows the policy incompetence is when Secretary of State John Kerry was challenged with the delisting of Qassem Soleimani. At first, he didn't know about it. Then he said, oh, it's a different Qassem Soleimani, only when the Iranian press came forward and said, no, this is the guy who's running Iran's operation in Syria, did it turn out that, well, John Kerry was just a complete fool.
Yeah, it's amazing how gullible Iran seems to think that we are. But they've been known to do things
like this.
Well, they're right. Yeah.
Ben, I mean, I'm sorry, they're absolutely right. We are that gullible, not we collectively in the audience, but the team which President Obama put together. I don't think we've ever seen a similar team in American history in terms of sheer and utter incompetence.
Well, before we go to break, I want to read you a tweet by the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, right after the announcement of this deal, just 8 minutes after the announcement of the deal. The Ayatollah Khamenei wrote on Twitter, it's partner nations like China and Russia who should be watched carefully, not Iran, to make sure that they honor the terms of the landmark bargain. You are well aware that some of the six states participating in negotiations are not trustworthy at all. That struck me as a strange statement, considering that Russia and China have, for a long time now, been the biggest enablers of rogue nations and bad actors in the region, including Iran. Do you have any idea what that was about?
Well, you know, when I read that, what I thought about was actually Great Britain, the United Kingdom. The Iranians traditionally and culturally have had an obsession with conspiracies emanating from Buckingham Palace. They make Lyndon LaRouche sound positively sane. In the United States, they may call us the Great Satan, but if you scratch an Iranian official, they'll say that Queen Elizabeth is actually running Dick Cheney, running Barack Obama, and so forth. So I suspect this was more just that typical Iranian psychosis and schizophrenia when it comes to the British. Regardless, at the very least, the Supreme Leader is just having a little bit of fun with President Obama. I mean, messing with him because, frankly, Obama has become the Supreme Leader's toy.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here. And then when I come back, Michael Rubin and I will talk about the ramifications of this deal for the U.S., Iran, and the Middle East in the near term and down the road. Back in just a minute. This portion of the podcast is sponsored by Fiverr. You've heard me rave about Fiverr before. That's Fiverr with two R's. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100 categories all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can possibly imagine, offered at a fixed base price of just $5. You know the announcer who does our intro on Kick-Ass Politics? I found him on Fiverr, a professional radio announcer to do our intro, just $5. And right now, when you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. And now, back to the show and my guest, Michael Rubin. We're back, and I'm talking with Michael Rubin about the recent Iran nuclear deal announced this week. Michael, they got this deal out of us. Obama's essentially a lame duck president at this point. Who knows what Iran will be working with after the 2016 election in terms of who will be in the White House. So is it possible that we've basically kicked off an 18-month race to the bomb?
Well, I think we've already kicked off the race to the bomb. I don't think the Republicans are really going to be able to do much about this agreement simply because President Obama was completely insincere all along. He and his critics and his proxies used the talking point. You can't criticize the agreement until you see it. But then once he made the agreement, he designed it in such a way so that it became a fait accompli and basically said, I've already lifted the sanctions. I mean, if you don't follow this agreement, then ultimately all you're going to do is let Iran have $100 billion without any commitments to it. And so he thinks he's being too clever by half. Even if Congress gets its act together, realizes that they're not going to sacrifice themselves for the ego of a lame duck president, well, there's already this United Nations Security Council resolution, this new one, which has been introduced. You can bet that Samantha Power, Obama's U.S. UN ambassador, is going to approve this, as well as the other members of P5 and Germany, for that matter. And you're going to have a situation in which all the sanctions are going to be lifted anyway, regardless of what Congress does. That said, President Obama taunts the press, taunts the Congress, saying, hey, there's no better alternative out there. That is absolute nonsense. It shows a complete ignorance of Iranian history, because twice before, under severe pressure, Ayatollah Khomeini at the time switched course. One was with regard to what it would take to release the U.S. hostages, and it was actually the severe isolation that Iran felt that caused Khomeini to change his mind. And the second one was what it would take to end the Iran-Iraq war. Khomeini had actually, Saddam Hussein started it, but Khomeini kept it going for 6 years more than he needed to, and ultimately was the tremendous cost to Iran's economy. When Khomeini announced the ceasefire in 1988, he said, and I quote, "It's like drinking a chalice of poison, but I have no choice if I want the Islamic Republic to survive. What we need to ask is, what's the equivalent of that figurative chalice of poison? The only thing I can say, and I can guarantee, it's not giving Iran $100 billion, but I should note, when people say unilateral sanctions don't work, the most biting sanctions on Iran were the unilateral sanctions imposed by the Clinton administration by executive order, or under the Bush and Obama administration by the U.S. Congress, the oil and trade sanctions in the Clinton administration, and the financial sanctions more recently."
Well, you know, speaking of the sanctions, in the agreement, it claims that if they violate the agreement, that these sanctions can essentially, quote, snap back. How fast do these can these sanctions snap back?
No, it's absolutely not true, Ben. I'm sorry. It's absolutely not true. In theory, you can say it could snap back and it could go to the United Nations, but there's no way to tell the difference between the equivalent of a misdemeanor and a felony. And in short, you have so many people in the White House and in the Kremlin, for that matter, that want this to succeed, that it's not going to get kicked back. And even if it does kick back, and this comes only after you go through a committee on which Iran sits, it's highly unlikely that you will have any snapback. And just to ensure that snapback becomes irrelevant, Iran's getting its $100 billion in advance. So what does it care?
So then in a larger context, what does this mean for the region? Have we now put ourselves in a position where in the near future we're going to be going through this exact same process, not just with Iran, but potentially with a half dozen other countries in the Middle East?
Well, ultimately, yes. I mean, I bet you as soon as that deal was announced, that you had the Saudis on the phone with the Pakistanis purchasing their own weaponry, what we've done in effect is not only politicize foreign policy in the U.S. context in a way that it's going to be hard to come back from. We've convinced our allies that they can't trust us, and that's not just in the region. That involves South Korea and Japan vis-a-vis North Korea and so forth, and we've convinced all this region that they have to build up arms to fight and survive themselves, because otherwise Iran is going to play roughshod over them. And then you have the taunting tweets, as you mentioned, from Hassan Rouhani and Khamenei basically saying, you got to be with us, otherwise you're against us and you don't want to be against us.
And now that we've essentially set off a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, who do you think is going to be next to pursue a military nuclear weapons program?
Well, I think it's going to go in order: Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey.
Before we go, the last thing I want to ask you, everyone talks a lot about breakout time, and supposedly this deal was going to extend the breakout time, the time that it takes for Iran to have a fully functioning nuclear weapon, from 2 or 3 months to a year. In your opinion, what was the breakout time for Iran before this deal, and what is the breakout time for a nuclear weapon now?
Well, I mean, after saying it had been a year for so long, finally Kerry and Obama came out and said it had fallen to 3 months beforehand under their stewardship. What this deal does is bring that breakout time, according to the administration, to a year. But that's assuming, A, that Iran doesn't have any covert program, and it's never not had a covert program, and two, that it even wants to break out, because if they just hold their horses, rather than build one crude nuclear bomb, they can have an arsenal of the most advanced nuclear weaponry in a matter of years without violating the deal.
Well, Michael Rubin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this deal that came out this week. Can this be resolved in Congress? Do you think that there's any solution at this point?
I think time will tell. I'm a historian, so I get paid to predict the past, but I don't have much faith in the Congress at this point.
I'll be honest, I don't either. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for coming on to talk to us about the deal. Scary stuff.
Thank you, Ben.
If you found my talk with Michael Rubin interesting, he's written extensively on the subject of the Iranian regime and their nuclear ambitions, and you can read more by going to his page on the American Enterprise Institute's website at aei.org. Thanks again to Michael for coming on the show and shedding some light on this unfortunate deal with Iran. On the bright side, until this week, I didn't realize that the leadership in Iran were such big fans of social media. As it turns out, Iran's President Rouhani and the Supreme Leader are basically 16-year-old high school girls, and they love, love, love to go on Twitter and talk trash about their new buddy, America. So if you want to have some fun with them, then get creative and come up with a clever hashtag to show your opposition to the nuclear deal with Iran. And while you're at it, be sure to tag us on Twitter when you do so. Our Twitter handle is @KAPolitics. So have fun with that, folks, and the winner of the best hashtag will have a fatwa declared against them by the Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you can automatically get new episodes as they become available. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you left us a review. That helps a lot with the show's rankings on iTunes. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics, or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us going and will be greatly appreciated. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com, or leave a voicemail on the toll-free listener hotline at 844-KA-POLITICS. In the next episode, we'll stay on this subject when we talk about the nuclear deal with Iran as it relates to Israel with my guest, Danny Ayalon. He's the former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., and he served as deputy foreign minister under the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He'll discuss what this deal means for Israel. I'll give you a hint, it's not good. Plus, we'll also talk about the frosty relationship between the Israeli Prime Minister and President Obama, and what Netanyahu's next move may be in response to a nuclear Iran. All that and more in the next podcast. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.